So last week, my mom and I stumbled upon a used bookstore in South Florida, and we walked in and gazed at all the shelves, and after looking and looking and looking, I settled upon Bogart, In Search of My Father by Stephen Humphrey Bogart. And I'm not really sure why I bought a book about Humphrey Bogart, because I've never been a fan or even paid that much attention to his career. But now I'm about 140 pages in, and all I want to do is tell people about Humphrey Bogart. That he drank with every meal, that he'd been married 3 times, that he couldn't fight a lick, that he and Frank Sinatra were boys. I am all Bogart all the time. And really, that's what I love about a book. When you crack it open and you can't put it down and you become totally obsessed. For me, that is bliss. My name is Jeff Perlman. I'm the New York Times bestselling author of 10 books and the host of Two Writers, Sling and Yang, a podcast where one writer, me, interviews another writer every single week. And today's guest is Casey Sager, the high school sports writer for Score Atlanta and the daughter of the late, great Craig Sager. This is episode number 340. Let's sling some yang.
Dad, your podcast sucks and you're culturally irrelevant.
Okay, Casey Sager, first of all, thank you so much for doing this. And we need to, I'm not going to bury the lead on this. Your dad is one of the most famous sort of broadcasters, Craig Sager, the late Craig Sager, in, you know, modern TV history, maybe all time sports TV history, known for crossing mediums, known for all sorts of genres, known for his wardrobe. And this is the first time you've ever used Zoom.
Okay, to be fair, he did all of his work like on note cards and stuff too. He never learned how to use email, so it might be genetic. I don't know.
Yeah, I can't let this one go. How exactly did you make it through COVID without ever Zooming?
Boundaries, maybe.
No, it is.
I don't especially love talking to a lot of people, so that might have been part of it. I moved up to Missouri a few years ago, and so my mom's whole extended family is up here, so I was seeing them pretty frequently too. And then I get like kind of stubborn about things and I'm like, okay, can we not do Zoom? Can we just like have a conversation over the phone or something instead? So
I feel like you're younger than me and yet you sound like my mother.
I think I've had like the personality of like a 7-year-old dude since I was like 12, probably.
That's very funny. And you told me you've never used an emoji. Is that actually true?
Yeah, that's actually, I don't know. I feel like at this point I can't. It's probably become like too much of my identity. It's not okay.
I kind of respect. So in a way you're like the anti, it's like at this point to use an emoji.
I'm very stuck in my ways.
And it'd be surrendering to something. It'd be acknowledging that
it became a stance for absolutely no reason, but I cannot let it go now.
Okay. I respect that. All right. So you're here for multiple reasons. Number one, as I said, your dad, the late great Craig Sager, you have entered the media world as well. And I'm actually really fascinated by that in many ways. You work for the Score Atlanta and you also write for the AJC. What I find weird here, okay, you were right, high school sporting events that happen in Georgia, but you live in Missouri. You're not actually attending the events that you are chronicling, which is a very modern way of, you know, doing this in a lot of ways. As an example, I have a story in front of me from the Atlanta Journal-Constitution with the Casey Sager byline, November 12th, 2022, Harrison 21, Brookward 17. After starting the season 1-6, 3-seed Harrison out of Region 3 has now won 3 of its last 4 games and is advancing to the second round of the playoffs following a 21-17 victory over Brookwood. Junior quarterback Braylon Ford accounted for 2 touchdowns for the Hoyas, including the game winner. You wrote that sitting in Missouri.
Okay, so the AJC usually has a few writers on site at a select few games. Usually during the regular season, I think it's 3 games that they pick. And then we supplement all of their coverage with like a roundup. So we start the night out running a live scoreboard for all 200 plus games. There are like something like 425 plus GHSA programs in Georgia. So we do a scoreboard for all of those games. And then I always write our lead and then as many others as I can. And then I edit the rest of them. But I mean, we're not on site and I feel like we can cover a lot more ground. We really try to get the entire state of Georgia, try to have a good balance of like metro teams versus like Southern Georgia teams. We try to make sure we're hitting as many classifications as possible too. Just as like comprehensive a coverage as we can possibly provide. So honestly, being on site really isn't an advantage. I'll probably be visiting Georgia in a few weeks to see my sister and my niece. And My stepdad is actually coaching at Blessed Trinity now. And so my sister was like, oh, cool, you get to go to one of the games with us. And I'm like, nope. If I'm there on a Friday night, like 100%, I will be just, I might even go into the office to do it. But it's just, it's never really an advantage to be there because we're just trying to scour our social media for as much information as we can possibly find. And then putting phone calls into coaches afterwards to supplement that information, or, and also a lot of times to confirm it, because there is a lot of really bad info out there for high school sports.
Can you make the argument? Because there's a lot of talk in media about the fear, like Gannett has started using AI to write sporting events.
Yeah.
And the idea is, now it's definitely had some glitches, but the idea is if we're just writing about some game that we were going to shove in the newspaper anyway, and it was just going to be score, highlight records, why do we need human beings writing those articles? And you're sitting in Missouri. Are you in a way an argument, a pro AI argument that, look, you don't even have to be at the games. You don't even have to be in the state. Anyone can do this, you know, if you just have a couple of basics.
I kind of see it as the opposite because I really don't make that great of money. And I mean, we're putting out like 50 plus game recaps a week. They're not especially long. Honestly, when I write too, my biggest focus is trying to credit as many of these kids as possible. A lot of them are not going to continue playing after the high school level. And I know that it's pretty cool to actually see them, you know, retweeting everything and like little excerpts from stuff that we're writing. Like they get so excited about that. I feel like what I do really matters. And I feel like I offer them, like, I think freedom of choice between like quality and quantity, because they're really not having to pay me that much money. But like, we've been doing what we've been doing for so long now that we are really effective at it. And it's honestly kind of bonkers, like how much work we get done on a Friday night with a really, really small team. So it's not that expensive to be putting out like just a little bit of effort. So you're not even saving that much money. And it's just, I don't know. I think it's super disrespectful, especially considering I know how cheap it is to actually do some form of coverage. I mean, most of our writers that we have are not actually writers. They're just, that's how I got started. My brother, they needed like an extra person in there for a day, and I volunteered to help out. And then it's the same way with a lot of the guys on our team. We have the same, pretty much everybody who's doing the writing still has been there as long as I have. And this is my 10th year doing it. So these are all like people in like their 30s and 40s that are willingly giving up every Friday night just because they feel like this is important and it matters. And it matters to these kids and it matters to the programs.
I want to make sure I understand this right also. We talked about it a little before I started recording. You work for The Score, and The Score basically covers high school sports, also delves into sports marketing, and some of the work from The Score is outsourced to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. So if we see an article by Casey in the AJC, you wrote it as an employee of The Score.
It's kind of complicated because my brother is technically an employee at Score Atlanta, but he's also technically an employee. Like, we get paid through Score Atlanta, so I guess they're technically my boss, but we're still working directly with like their editors and their teams and everything there too. And
I'm just trying to figure out how sort of the niche. Well, because, okay, when I was a young writer coming up, I was a preps writer for the Nashville Tennessean, and they'd send you out to a game and you worked for the Tennessean, and then you come back. I mean, I'm old. You come back to the Tennessean office, you type it up, blah, 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 blah. Next weekend, you go to another game. It wasn't like you would also have this company that had employees that they also worked for and blah, blah. And it definitely is a different age of media and journalism. And you were telling me how The Score, it's not just a company that provides writers to cover prep games. It's a company that works on marketing. It's a company that works on broadcast. It seems like you work for an outfit that does a lot of things with a lot of tentacles in Atlanta sports.
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I have so much fun there, because I feel like I get to do something different. Like every single day that I was showing up, it was just something different every day. And honestly, like, they were so desperate for help on a lot of times. And I know that my brother probably vouched for me too, that I do pick things up pretty quickly. Like one of the first things I ever did for them was I was the final set of eyes on their media guide for the Falcons for like the entire season. I'm like, you're really trusting me to do this? Okay. But I mean, it went well. It's just, I mean, it's whatever they need help with that day is usually, you know, what I'll help with. And I like feeling useful. You know, I've gotten to see a lot of pretty cool things and work with a lot of pretty cool people. And
you guys created the Atlanta United FC game day programs for a while. What happened?
Actually, that was probably the first thing I did for Score Atlanta, was we also handled all of like the distribution of the programs. So we would have them printed, and then we would meet our the distributors at the Georgia Dome and then at Mercedes-Benz Stadium after that. And we'd put them all out on all the seats, and Craig and I would have to coordinate this whole team and we'd be like shouting across the dome. It was a lot of fun. And then the first season that we had Atlanta United, they started tearing up all of the game day programs and dumping them in their beer so they could throw wads of paper at each other during the game. I don't know if that's like just a soccer thing or what, but it was, everything was getting like basically like plastered to the ground, and it was taking them forever to scrape it off. So they stopped doing all of the game day programs, which is kind of a bummer.
Wait, so I have to say, on social media, you're kind of a badass motherfucker. Like, you do not. I'm sure sometimes there's someone's chagrin in your life, because I'm kind of the same way. And like, you definitely don't hold back. And again, for those who might not know, your dad, Craig Sager, long time NBA sort of staple, passed away in 2016. I just want to say, you gave an amazing, amazing, amazing eulogy for your father that really seems to exude both you and him. And I want to say one thing you said is 2016. You said, over the past couple of years, and especially in the last few days, I've been overwhelmed by all the lovely things that everyone has had to say about my father. And I just keep thinking to myself, have any of these people ever met him? I heard that he lived his life with grace. Grace? Really? We are talking about a man who hopped a fence while I was streaking at the Kentucky Derby and tore open his whatever the church appropriate euphemism for balls is. Hardly graceful. And the whole eulogy is just, I mean, lovely and wonderful. Your dad was such an enormous presence in media. People loved his outfits. People made fun of his outfits, the banter he had with different Kobe to Shaq to Tracy McGrady, on and on and on. When you yourself decide to go into sports media, it seems like that's a pretty big shadow to be have over you. Does it feel that way, or is it not that at all?
That's complicated. I think a lot of people wanted me to follow more closely in his footsteps, especially once I did start writing. People were really trying to push me. I mean, even still, people think, I think they think that I want to be like on the sidelines or something. And I absolutely 100% do not at all. That is not my jam at all. And there were a couple of years there where I was especially covering a lot more NBA, and I was maybe forcing it a little bit. Just personally, it's just not my comfort zone. I would have to kind of do this like compartmentalization where I would, I don't know, like embody a version of myself that didn't have anxiety for a brief moment. Like, I would have to like figure out how to like put it in a box and just set it off to the side, and then like ask my questions. And then after the game, I'd get in my car and then I'd have my little panic attack afterwards. And like, I was functioning, but like, it's not fun for me. And there were a lot of other people there that like, I know they want it more than me. And I liked being in that environment. I liked seeing a lot of the people, especially, you know, with the Hawks, there are a lot of really great people working there. And it was nice for me to, you know, walk those halls that I used to follow my dad around in when we were little, and we used to go to games with him when we were younger. And it was nice to be in that world again, like as an adult, and to see all these people again. But I think a lot of them wanted something different for me than what I wanted for myself. And I feel like, I don't know, like, I think there's not really any set career path in that industry anyway. I don't know. I think a lot of people view maybe even high school sports as like a step down, or it should be like high school and then you cover college and then maybe you cover pros after that. And I did the inverse of it, but I just found so much more of a home with high school sports, and I felt so much more comfortable with it. And especially, you know, with a behind the scenes role to an extent too.
When your dad died in 2016, you were doing what?
Okay. So I was on, I think, year three then of high school coverage. I was writing for B-Ball Breakdown at the time. That was my second year where I at least went to every home Hawks game. I would cover some of them, but mostly like, I just like being there. And I was still, that was towards the end of my 13 years in bars and kitchens. So I was still, I think at that point, trying to make my way out of the restaurant industry.
Wait, I didn't. Okay, time out. This is not in your, not listed in the old resume online. All right. So for 13 years, you worked doing what?
I managed bars and kitchens. One of them actually, Jocks and Jill's was a chain restaurant that my dad started with Doc Rivers and Randy Whitman and Scott Hastings. And they had a handful of those. So that was, I don't know, every time that they would, you know, be short staffed or something, I would kind of feel like obligated to go step in and help them. And then I would get sucked right back in for a couple more years, because that's just what the service industry does to you. So, yeah.
Wait, it's really interesting, because usually there are many, many tales of athletes who have famous parents usually fathers in sports, and the kid goes into sports and it comes with all these expectations, you know, and like, and it's always like, well, why aren't you blank? Why aren't you as good as your dad? Oh, big shoes to fill with your dad, you know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, on a, there are very few Kobe Bryants who are much, much better than their dads. Oftentimes it's the opposite. It's the kid tries to be whatever. And I'm not saying you're better or worse than your dad. You do a totally different thing. But it does seem like it must get tiring to have people either comparing you to your father or asking you when you're going to blank. When are you going to be on TV? Blank. Where's your funny outfit? Blank. Where's your blank? That has to weigh on a person after a while, no?
I think that my brother gets it a little worse than I do, being Craig Sager the second. I feel like, especially, I've been on Twitter for so long at this point too, that like a lot of the people who follow me have followed me for a while now. And I think they know what I'm about. And like, I mean, I wear hoodies, like probably 7 days a week. Like I am not, I don't know. There's a lot. I am not my dad. I'm really not. We have some things in common, but I don't know. I think what annoys me is when people think that that's what I want and that I'm just like failing at it. But it only annoys me as long as, you know, as soon as I can like explain myself and clarify. And if they're still like trying to misunderstand that, then they're determined to hate me at that point. So, I mean, even this morning I had somebody telling me, like, they called me a bitch and said that I was trying to ride my dad's coattails because I posted a picture of him interviewing Deion Sanders. And it was just so silly. I'm like, how am I trying to ride? Like, honestly, I mow 14 yards a week. I do a lot of small engine repair. I do embroidery and stuff. Like, that's like, if I'm, I don't know. I feel like I'm doing nepotism really, really badly if that's actually my end goal. So I don't know. If I feel like people make assumptions. Most of the time they're wrong. Whatever.
You're insanely, what's the right word? I mean, entertaining, pointed, whatever, on social media. And the one that pops up, if you just do a search for you and social media,
I will never do that. That sounds scary.
I only did it because I knew I'd be interviewing you. Okay. Is you going hard after former ESPN anchor Britt McHenry? I mean, it was like, oh my God, you kind of killed Britt McHenry. And you tweeted at her, you pissed away your career being a spoiled brat. And that thing went uber viral.
I just started dating a guy like a week before that.
Yeah.
And like his friend came into town and I'm hanging out with him and I'm hanging out with his friend and he's getting, he got a notification on his phone, like from Bleacher Report with like Craig Sager's daughter, like eviscerates like Britt McHenry or something. I'm like, oh my God, it was so embarrassing. So I'm like, just ignore that. Please ignore that. That was an interesting day.
All right, another headline also found on Instagram. NBA reporter Craig Sager leaves three of his children out of will. Oldest daughter, Casey Sager, slams stepmom. I am a horrible person on Twitter. I am. Like, my wife is like, can you just stop tweeting? And I'm like, I know. And I stop. You do have a very like kind of balls to the walls. I'm just going to throw it out there. Bam, Twitter thing. I guess why and why?
There are times, honestly, that I look back at a few years ago and it's just, it feels like a lot of that like happened to somebody else entirely. Like I don't even, my cousins are all up here and I watch their kids a lot and like I'm really close with them now and I don't even know how to talk to them about my life before I came up here to Missouri because it's just, it's insane to me that like there was a period of my life where TMZ was writing articles about me and my family. Like that's just, it's very silly. A lot of it is boundaries too. Like when I had the incident with Britt McHenry, it was because she started talking shit about my brother for no reason. I don't know. My biggest source of anxiety typically is feeling like I'm being misunderstood about something. So I feel like if I have an opportunity to explain myself as clearly as possible and say what I feel needs to be said, at that point, like it's out of my hands. And so once I get to the point that I feel like I have clearly expressed myself, like I'm not going to feel any more anxiety about that situation. I'm either just going to walk away from it or I don't know. Like there are times people ask why I respond to certain like trolls about things. it's not about that individual. It's because they like that response. What they're saying to me is giving me an opportunity to say something that I feel needs to be said in general.
I see.
So like, I'm never responding individually to that person. It's okay. This is a moment where I have a chance to say what I feel it needs to be said at this point. So I don't know. I really honestly, truly don't have any regrets about any of that stuff. It's kind of shocking to me sometimes that like we did kind of make it through all of that. Like, cause to an extent, I was basically running PR for my family too, especially like when my dad was still battling leukemia, just, you know, what information needed to be out to the public and, you know, how things were being spun. And it was a lot, but I survived it.
I think a lot about how the celebrity culture and celebrity is sick culture, right? That we have in media. First of all, you'll see on social media, like someone's sick. It could be anyone. The lead singer for Kiss is sick, or the, you know, wide receiver for the Lions is sick. And people start tweeting like prayers up, prayers up, prayers up. And I always think like, are you really praying or are you just typing prayers up? Right. And I feel like when your dad was sick, I don't know if you ask yourself this. I always find myself thinking this. Are people genuinely concerned or do they just love celebrity gossip? And let's see a picture of Craig Sager looking shrunken in his red jacket. And I wonder what that was like to go through, to have someone you loved, who you were very close with, die in front of the media glare.
He is not the first family member that I lost. Honestly, I lost two aunts, three uncles, my dad, and all four grandparents in about a decade. But it was definitely the first time that I had to go through that on a public stage. You bring up a good point with like the images of him being really sick. That has always been the most jarring thing to me. There's a reason that when I post anything about him, I typically post pictures of him when he was healthy, because that's what he is to me in my mind. That's how I still picture him. And it does kind of bother me that like all of the tributes to him are always pictures of him when he was really sick and really emaciated. And like, you know, the ESPYs was in July. So, you know, it's 5 months before he died. I definitely prefer seeing pictures of him when he looked healthy. I mean, I think obviously there are some people that were just, you know, trying to say something to say something, but I would say that the majority of that was very genuine. I was actually still working at another one of the locations of his restaurants when he first got diagnosed. And so people were coming in and like, hey, doesn't Craig Sager own this place? Like, isn't he dying? And be like, oh, that's actually my dad. But they did seem, I mean, even not knowing who I was, even not knowing about any of that, like they still did seem genuinely concerned about him. I know it affected people. I know it did. I know people miss him.
Forget basketball, forget whatever, you know, suits. What was your dad like as a dad?
He's a ridiculous individual. Who he was on TV, that's really, I mean, that's who he was. He was just, he wanted everyone to have a good time. You know, like the scene in Caddyshack where he's like, hey, everybody, we're all getting laid. Like that was like my dad, that's his favorite movie. That's his favorite scene. That's who he was. If we were going grocery shopping, like he would just like grab a case of beer and crack one open. Like when we're walking down the aisle, honestly, I don't know how he didn't get arrested for all of the streaking he used to do.
Wait, so your dad really used to streak?
Oh my God. Yes.
Explain that. Wait, explain that. Why did your dad used to streak?
Cause he was just, I don't know. He was like 20, like his whole life. I don't know. I ended up like with the personality of an old man, and he had the personality of a 20-year-old his entire life. I don't know. His favorite song was Get Off of My Cloud. Like he just wanted to have a good time all the time. And he hated a buzzkill more than anything. Like you could not be a buzzkill around him. He would tell you were being a buzzkill the second you started being a buzzkill. But like when my mom would be dropping us off from school, if he was on one of his runs or something and he knew that we were driving behind him, he'd yank his pants down and moon us like the whole way, like on Roswell Road in Marietta, Georgia. So honestly, I don't know how it wasn't an issue. It would probably be an issue these days.
Was he at all a disciplinarian as a dad or zero?
No. Not once, I don't think. I'm actually trying to remember. Nope. My mom handled that.
Again, like my dad was an accountant, right? My dad was an accountant. And I used to think going to work with my dad was actually really cool because my dad ran an accounting firm and you'd go in and Stan Perlman would be running the shop. And I was like, oh, this is so cool. And your dad was like this, you know, kind of iconic figure in NBA circles and sports circles. Was it cool? Was it neat? Or was it just, oh, that's my dad on TV?
Oh, no, it was awesome. We love sports. I mean, honestly, he would have been really embarrassed, I think, if we had ever, you know, fangirled or something out meeting somebody. He was always, he just wanted us to talk to people like people. Even now, I don't ever really ask for autographs or pictures. Like, I try to avoid doing that. But I mean, there was still, even as a kid, like, I mean, Space Jam was our favorite movie growing up too. Just being around, like, I definitely, even as a very young kid, remember like being like, okay, this is pretty freaking awesome. And trying not to lose it, like trying to, you know, act like I'd been there before, because that's definitely what he wanted us to do. But no, it was, I knew it was cool. It was very cool.
What was the most awesome moment as kid?
Oh man. We took Charles Barkley to Show and Tell.
Wait, what?
Yeah, we all individually took Charles Barkley to Show and Tell. I dominated Show and Tell, because even if it wasn't something that like my dad gave us, like I had two rabbits that had four babies. So I was either like bringing in like baby bunnies or like my tree frogs, or there's that place in Atlanta, Freedman Shoes. That's where a lot of the NBA players shop for shoes, because they have all of like the really, really big sizes. And so he used to take, whenever he would go out to like an away game or something, he would pick up shoes from Freedman's to take to, you know, Shaq or somebody who he knew he was going to see. So we used to have some pretty ridiculous shoes in the basement too. Although he brought all of those into my school once, my elementary school, and like was like showing them off, you know, like this is the size of Shaq's shoe. And there was a rumor for like a really long time that my dad sold shoes for a living. And I had to like keep correcting people. I'm like, it's not really what he does, but I don't know. It was definitely, I knew it was ridiculous and I knew it was cool, but we still had a relatively, like, I wouldn't say normal upbringing, but he kept us out like really late on school nights. That's why I still have absolutely no sleep schedule at all. If there was like a Hawks game or something on like a Tuesday night, we would go to it. And then we would stay, like I'd stay up too to watch him do his interviews.
I feel like you buried the lead here. So you took Charles Barkley to Show and Tell.
Yeah, I might have actually been in middle school at that point. But he took him in to go see my sister Show and Tell, and then my brother, because they were both still in elementary school, and then they came by to see me too.
Before we continue with Two Writers Slinging Yang, oh, that's the name of the podcast, a quick word from our sponsor.
Hey, this is Jeff Perlman. And I'm here with my dad, Stan Perlman, who's wearing a throwback Herschel Walker New Jersey Generals jersey from RoyalRetros.com. Dad, I'm confused. Why Herschel Walker?
You know, there just aren't that many Jews who play professional sports. So I wanted to support one of our greatest.
Dad, Herschel Walker's not Jewish.
Herschel Shmuel Walker. He most certainly is. I went down to Wrightsville, Georgia in 1977 to attend his bar mitzvah at the Wrightsville Ramada. Pickled herring was served. Wonderful time.
Dad, maybe it's senility, but Herschel Walker definitely isn't Jewish. He's Christian. He loves Trump. He thinks the earth is flat.
Why ruin an old man's dreams?
There was one thing on Twitter that I thought actually really caught my eye that you wrote, and it was someone was mocking Chris Hayes, the sideline reporter, after he kind of hugged a player after interviewing him. And said he's being a kiss ass. Mm-hmm. You went hard and you posted photos of your dad sort of embracing players and making the argument basically that you're not kissing ass of someone to whatever, show affection. And I wonder, like, I'm kind of interested. Your dad's not here and we live in a really fucked up era of journalism. We really do, where boundaries are being crossed left and right and left and right, and newspapers are shutting down. And there's a lot of like media loving athletes, not being hard on athletes, not asking hard questions of athletes. And I wonder, how do you think your dad felt about himself as a journalist and how he felt about journalism? Did he view himself as a journalist or did he view himself as an entertainer?
See, I don't think he ever did view himself as a journalist. He was originally, like when he got his start, I mean, he got his start being on the field when Hank Aaron hit his 715th home run. That was back when he was still kind of like a one-man band. Like he used to go around trying to cover as many events as he possibly could, high school, whatever. I mean, anything he could possibly do. And at that point, I would say that that was more journalism. But I was born in 86. And I think from that point on, he really wasn't ever doing a lot of writing. He was reporting, but I don't think he viewed himself as a journalist later on.
How do you think he saw himself?
It's a really good question.
Thanks. That's why I make the note box.
I know, but now I'm thinking about it. I mean, honestly, like probably the same way that like a lot of us saw him. I don't know. I think a lot of people think that he really like he was just obsessed with like being in the spotlight. But to me, like he was the spotlight. So I think that, you know, just being places, like, he made these events feel like a bigger deal just because he was there, just because he had this like crazy knack for being in the right place at the right time for so many years that like it made just him by him showing up, it made it feel bigger because he had already, like, he was kind of like this like Forrest Gump type figure where he was showing up everywhere. I mean, being on the field for Hank Aaron's 715th home run, the night before Seattle Slew won the Triple Crown, he slept in Seattle Slew's stall. He ended up getting a big pile of horse shit, like in resin. Like he got it, like he like, yeah, he was really weird. He had a lot of really weird souvenirs.
Wait, do you still have Seattle Slew's shit in resin?
It was in his basement. So that would be something that my stepmom probably got rid of.
I'm sorry, time out 1 second. We need to focus on this for a minute. Your dad sleeps in Seattle Slew's stall before he wins a Triple Crown.
Yes.
Besides, this is a very historic moment. I need to preserve some of Seattle Slew's shit.
Yes.
Takes his shit, has it fossilized, puts it in the basement.
Yes.
So basically what you're saying is you grew up not only the daughter of Craig Sager, but also, I guess you could say, the half sibling of Seattle Slew's shit.
We had a really weird basement. It's a lot of like, we had Michael Jordan's first home run ball. So that was cool. Okay. But like whenever we had friends or something over, we would always give like the tour. And I definitely always like, this is horse poop.
That's amazing. That's super weird.
He was a weird dude. He was a really weird dude.
Wait, I love that. Was he weird? Would you say your dad was a weird guy?
Oh, yeah.
I'm looking at a picture of your dad right now wearing one of the worst jackets I've ever seen in my life. And I say that adoringly. It's like yellow and red roses and it's black and with white splotches. Was he a guy who enjoyed the spotlight and enjoyed being discussed? And that was the impetus for wearing stuff like that? Or
I think he like kind of saw himself as like a mirror to like reflect the spotlight onto that moment, maybe. Uh-huh. So whatever attention he was bringing to himself by dressing like that, it wasn't like it was about drawing necessarily more attention to him. It was about just, he was a spectacle. And I think that he made it more of a spectacle by being there. I don't know. I never really got the impression that like he made it about himself.
Yeah.
The closest comp I've ever come with, like in my mind, he was a little bit like Anthony Bourdain kind of. Like he was just like a window into like this world. So like even though like he didn't have to be impartial necessarily because he knew these guys and he was, you know, giving them a chance to the way they would, you know, have these like genuine real conversations with him. I think that like he was getting something different out of these guys than the job usually entails. And I'm not saying that like you're bad at your job if you don't do that. It's just how he did it.
Yeah. Wait, I just want to say Tampa Bay Times, this is after your father passed. 3 years after Hank Aaron's historic homer, while covering the Belmont Stakes, Mr. Sager slept in Seattle Slew's stable the night before the Thoroughbred won the Triple Crown. Before leaving to take the horse for a morning walk, Mr. Sager wrote, he scooped up a piece of Seattle Slew's excrement and preserved it for the next 39 years as a fragment of history. I just have to say, Casey, with all respect for your late father, that is both disturbing and disgusting.
Oh, yeah. I'm actually pretty proud of myself that I got the details right, too. That would have been embarrassing if you were like fact checking me and I was wrong. No, I'm trying to remember what else. Morgana's bra. He had Morgana's bra in our basement and there were two basketballs that were sitting in each cup.
I know your parents are divorced, but like when they were married, would your mom be like, can you get this shit out of the basement?
I don't know. She might be like a bigger sports fan than he ever was. Actually, she definitely is. My dad loved like sports, but like my mom was like a fanatic. She's the reason that I'm Casey. My parents met at a Royals game. And so they named me Casey after the Royals and the Chiefs. Cause she's always been like a diehard Royals and Chiefs fan. So that would be why I was raised a Kansas City fan in Atlanta. She's pretty nuts too, though. Okay, so they met at a Royals game. They had their first date 3 days later. They got engaged 1 week after their first date. And then they got married like 2 months later as soon as the baseball season ended. And then my dad and my mom moved down to Atlanta so my dad could be one of the first employees at CNN. A lot of these crazier stories, she was very much there like documenting them too. I mean, she reined him in a little bit as much as he possibly could have been.
I mean, she lived with the horseshit. So like she did actually live with the horseshit in the same house as Seattle Slew's shit.
Oh, yeah.
She couldn't have been that tough. I feel like in a lot of ways your dad doesn't get, and I'm being sincere about this, the credit he probably deserves. Like every now and then your dad definitely is depicted in a sort of cartoonish and lighthearted way, which sounds fair actually. But like That's a CNN original. He joined CNN in 1981. He worked for TV stations in Florida. He worked in Kansas City. In 1990, he moves to Turner Sports. He also covered the NFL, college football, basketball, MLB. He was a TV journalist before he was the guy on the sidelines in the suits.
Correct. And I think a lot of people think that the wardrobe was the basis for his appeal. Right. I think it's missed on a lot of people how good he actually was at his job.
Your dad was unafraid to ask questions. Like, your dad was not a wallflower. He was willing to sort of ask an NBA player any question he wanted to ask him. He wasn't like just throwing roses at him all the time. I mean, he had a news background in a funny suit, outfitted body.
He graduated from Northwestern. Like, he had the whole pedigree for it.
So your dad was 65 when he died. To lose a parent, and at the moment, it's incredibly sad and incredibly tragic. And as time passes, people probably share warmer and warmer memories, and you're able to think warmly of your dad. But as we sit here 7 years, which is crazy, it's been 7 years after your dad passed, is there still pain about it? Is there anger or anything about losing a parent as the years pass, or do you just get by that?
Okay, so trying to figure out how to phrase this. It's definitely a process. I feel like I have been on good terms with my grief for a really long time now. I think it's also why it was really why giving that eulogy was really important to me, because that I feel was me kind of establishing like how I wanted to talk about him from there on out. It really was bumming me out that so many of the conversations were based on the cancer and everything. So I try to steer the conversations in certain directions and have that be like what I want people to focus on about him. And I think that's helped having some control over that. There's definitely a lot of moments where like it'll hit like during Jimmy V week. If I don't know that that's happening, I look up the TV and all of a sudden it'll have like a clip of my dad doing like his ESPYs speech. That kind of catches me off guard sometimes. And that's a little tough when I'm not like expecting it. But I think I'm doing okay. It's hard to feel bad for him. He had a really, really, really great life. He did a lot of ridiculous things.
Toward the end, do you feel like he was accepting of it, or was he kicking and screaming, you know, I don't want to go?
Okay, so he came home in early December because they said that he fought tooth and nail. Like, they told him in, I guess it would probably would have been the spring of 2015 that he had like 2 weeks left to live. And then they did chemo every day for 24 hours for 2 straight weeks so they could completely flesh out his system and my brother could donate bone marrow for the second time. So I think there were a lot of moments where, I don't know, he went into remission a few times. His biggest thing was about getting back onto the court. And so he wasn't necessarily like as cautious as he could have been. Like, I think that he maybe rushed back a few times just because that was the most, like, he just really wanted to get back to work no matter what. And when he went to MD Anderson in Houston. So I remember there was one playoff series where he was actually doing like the commute between Houston and I think San Antonio, like every single day to come back for the chemo. And so I think when it got to the point where they told him there was nothing more they could do for him, they said that he probably had a couple more months left. And I said, nope, I don't think that's going to be the case at all. And he died, I think two weeks after that. Once he didn't have that goal of getting back out onto the court anymore, once he knew that wasn't going to happen, I think he was kind of ready to stop fighting it.
May 10th, 2016, you tweeted, "My dad is in the middle of 8 days of chemo, drove 3.5 hours from Houston to San Antonio to work this game, driving back in the AM. Absurd." When he was doing that, are you like, "Dad, this is awesome. I'm so proud of you." Or were you more like, "Dad, what the fuck are you doing?"
Both. I knew it was a really bad idea. I knew he should have been taking it easy in theory, but he did everything on his own terms, including battling cancer, including dying. And I'm happy for him that he got that. I don't know. It would not have been him if he would have done it any differently.
You work in media, but it's obviously a totally different type of media than your dad was working in. Did you learn anything from your dad and his career that applies to you and your career?
The most important thing to him was always the relationships. So I think that's always been a priority of mine. Just to make sure that I'm keeping in touch with people, especially the people that really cared about him, because there are a lot of people that have really gone out of their way to make sure that we know that like we're still family and everything to them. So I know that was always really important to him. So I've always tried to prioritize that. A lot of questions too. I mean, we were the first time that he was never able to be in town for my birthday, because my birthday is in April. It was always right at the start of the NBA playoffs. So one silver lining of him being sick is, you know, we actually got to spend my birthday together and watch the NBA playoffs together. And he would kind of analyze like the questions that were being asked. So there are a lot of times where I'll hear questions that like kind of make me cringe a little bit, just because I've heard him explain why that's not necessarily like the best route to take with things. And yeah, just like treating people like people, and everyone's just a person. Everyone just wants to have like a normal conversation with you. And I would say that's probably like, I don't know. He had this whole thing about just acting like you were supposed to be somewhere and just walking into anywhere and not getting stopped and just being confident. And I don't know, I cannot do that. I always feel like I have this like underlying fear that I'm being a pain in someone's ass all the time. Like the way he jumped on the field to go interview Hank, like that is not in me at all. And there were a lot of times where he would like want to encourage me to like go try something. And I'm like, nope, I'm going to sit this one out because it's just not me.
I just want to say your dad was 100,000,000% right. And I actually learned that from covering Barry Bonds when he was playing for the Giants. And I used to say that guy just walks everywhere like he belongs, like he knows he belongs. And I hated Barry Bonds. He was a douchebag, but like no one ever had the guts to stop him, because most of us have a little timidness in us and we don't want to be embarrassed and we don't want to belong. And if you walk like you just belong on the field, if you walk like you just belong on the court, if you walk like, of course I'm going to be in the front row, I've sit in the front row. 95% of the time you wind up going exactly where you want to go.
I mean, it helped that he was like a 6'4" white dude. Like, I mean, I've heard the story of when Hank hit the 715th home run, that they had like the security guard there and those two guys that jumped and ran around the bases with him. Like the guy had his finger on the trigger of this gun because he didn't know what was going to happen at all. So, I mean, honestly, it's a different time now. I said something like in my eulogy that would basically, but he's 22. He's 22 years old. Like it was, imagine if they had just let like some 22-year-old blogger jump on the court at the NBA finals and then do the interview. Like they let him interview him after that. Like I think a lot of other people would have gotten tackled. He had one location of the Jocks and Jills at the CNN Center. So we used to go there a lot after Hawks games. And it helped that he had really long legs because he was already like halfway down the hall by the time people would see him. So there's one time there's like a 2-hour wait or something and he's in front of us and I'm like in the back of the group and everyone is just, they didn't recognize him and they're all yelling at him. They're like, hey, sweater vest, where do you think you're going? Like there's a line here. And so he's already gone. He doesn't even hear it. And I'm saying, like, I'm sorry. It's okay. Like he owns it. We're supposed to be in here. It's okay. I do not have that in me at all. And usually I would be the one who would hesitate. And then I'd be the one who'd have to answer to the person asking why the hell we were all in there.
Let me ask you a final question. So I always ask on this podcast, I ask people who've covered a lot of sports what their worst moment with an athlete was. But I'm going to go a little creative here. You have worked in restaurants.
Oh, God.
Give me the worst moment in your time at restaurants.
At Jocks and Jills. Probably. Okay. So my first week that I was there, the very first server job I ever had was when I had the whole plate of drinks on a tray and someone grabbed a pink lemonade off. And it was like this whole group of business people that were there for lunch. And I dumped like 14 drinks on this guy's lap. Amazing. Don't ever, ever, ever take anything off of a tray that a server is holding. Don't ever do that. Also, there was a time that the kitchen caught on fire and we had to like quickly get everyone out and then nobody got to pay for anything. That was a nightmare.
Is it true working in food services is a, like we see on TV, a glorious and glamorous job full of luxury and excitement and thrill a minute fun? Is that what the food industry is like? Is it exactly like that? Is it just like that, Casey?
No, you just smell like French fry grease and ranch dressing all the time. All the time. It's still kind of crazy to me that I just get to sit and watch an entire day of football on Saturdays and Sundays now. I did not get that before. Probably 10 straight years, I was working every Saturday and Sunday for football stuff. But I think it set me up to not really, like, I don't know. The idea of a 9-to-5 is very foreign to me. So I think it's been helpful that, like, I don't know, a lot of people, when we try to get them to like write for us, like they want to take off like Saturdays and Sundays to like go to games and stuff. And it's like, you can't really be in this industry and expect to have a normal like schedule like that. And also sports happen on the weekends. So I think that kind of, I don't know, the chaos of kitchens kind of set me up for the chaos of what we do on Friday nights too. Like there are just so many balls in the air at all times. And it doesn't really ever overwhelm me because I feel like chaos is kind of my natural habitat. It's just always just a goat rodeo everywhere.
But you know what? Honest to God, I'd rather live my life that way. I'd rather have never a dull moment than a lot of dull moments.
I don't think I have ever once been bored in my entire life. Yep. Like genuinely, I don't think it's ever happened.
Well, Casey, I appreciate your time doing this. I truly do. I am now a fan of your Twitter feed because who the fuck knows what you're going to say? And I enjoy that very much. And I feel like you were raised by a really cool, interesting dad. And I feel like you are a really cool, interesting person. So clearly some of that is rubbed off on you. And
well, thank you.
Yeah. And thank you so much for doing this. And thanks for making your Zoom debut. It's a big deal. Not every day.
Immediately deleting it off my computer after this.
I don't blame you.
I want to thank today's guest, Casey Sager, for joining me on Two Writers Slinging Yang. You can follow Casey on Twitter at The Sager Bomb and read her work, The Score Atlanta. If you have a chance and enjoy Two Writers Slinging Yang, please go to the vehicle of your choice and leave a nice review. I'd really appreciate it. Music is by the great MC White Owl. Thanks again for joining me. And remember, keep writing.